So welcome, Garland readers, to a very interesting interview with somebody who was recommended by our book reviewer, Dee Wood, Pam Hall, whose Encyclopedia of Local Knowledge project is a very impressive and curious one. As you know, Garland is a great supporter of the local as a source of creative diversity, so I was very struck in the website with its description as exploring art as a form of making and moving knowledge, and reveals many ways of knowing that are local, living, and still fruitfully in use. And looking through this encyclopedia, there's quite interesting entries. There's an entry for twine needles, traditional First Nations instruments, and boat building from birch bark. It's a very grounded kind of encyclopedia. Pam herself is an artist with an extensive career working with communities, such as an installation of used aprons and fields of winter wheat sown with symbols of sustenance during a crisis in the cod fishing industry. So it's wonderful to meet with you this evening, your time. Pam, can we start by telling us a little about where you are and paint a picture of your environment so the reader can go on a little journey to understand where you're from?
I'm not sure I'm exactly on the opposite part of the globe as you are. You're in Melbourne, I think.
Correct.
But I'm in Newfoundland, which is an island off the easternmost coast of Canada and sits in the North Atlantic about 18,000 kilometers away from you. And it is the North Atlantic. So it is a climate of hard rock and water, as a lot of the folk songs and folklore in this place describe it. It is raw, rural, with a few small cities, one of which I live and work in, which is St. John's, the capital, which is a very, very old city. You know, it was colonized by the Brits and the French, who were chasing codfish across the Atlantic Ocean and hit Newfoundland and went, "Oh my God, we've never seen this many fish. Let's take this place over." So I've been living here for 50 years now.
If you were to walk outside now, what would it feel like?
It would be about 2 degrees Celsius above zero. It's winter, but it's not white yet. Normally we would get snow before Christmas, but global warming is keeping us kind of with slush and rain. It's fresh. I'm in an old city, in a wooden city, really. It's filled with beautiful old houses built out of wood rather than stone. And the stone was saved for the churches, really. So it's an old, small city, maybe 150,000 people, walkable. If you walk out my front door and turn left, you can walk for 7 minutes and be in the oldest harbor in North America. So it's a lovely city, but an even more astonishing province.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us into this wonderland that you paint. Can we now look at your career as an artist? What are the kinds of themes, materials, techniques that have constituted your work?
I think I would be safely described as an interdisciplinary artist. Certainly, I was trained as a visual artist in printmaking and painting and design. But I've been working site specifically on the land and in buildings, not always museums and galleries, sometimes on fishing wharves, sometimes in farmers fields. For many years, I use a variety of media and tools from a variety of disciplines, you know, so I make sculpture, I use textiles, I use photography and performance and video. And when people ask me what kind of artist I am, I say, well, how long have you got? And send them to my website, because it's a long story. And if you practice professionally for 40 or 50 years, you know, you end up exploring a lot of stuff in a lot of ways. So I think I am inquiry driven. My first impulse is to use my practice as a way to explore my world. Sure. And that shapes the work I do and the questions I explore, which are centrally about humans in an environment, in a place which is still wild in many ways, and about work. And I worked around the fishery for many, many years, which is about primarily male labor, but I've been working around female labor for about the last 10 or 15 years. And that's what I'm working on right now.
Right.
And yeah, and I moved away from the center of Canada. I came here 50 years ago from Montreal, one of those excellent centers of excellence, kind of like New York or Paris for artists. And so I've always been very conscious of the local and the margins, the peripheries and the center. And I think, you know, as bell hooks always said, the margins are an excellent place for resistance and to challenge the conceptions and assumptions of the center, which are usually assumptions about power. So my work is quite political in its way, and does kind of come from an impulse to use my practice as a way to reveal things that otherwise would remain invisible. So it's really like my daughter said, Mom, your practice is you pointing at things going, look!
And it seems something quite special about Newfoundland as a space. I recall Glenn Gould's wonderful Symphony of Voices, The Idea of North, which spoke to the what isolation, the sort of space of thoughtfulness and I guess a sense of authenticity in isolation, that you're not trying to follow the trends of the center, but more grounded in what you can establish yourself in that place.
I think one of the things that always drew me here, coming from the center, 50 years ago, was that there was no pretense of control. This is not a mastery and control kind of place. People die every year on the North Atlantic, both in the oil industry and in the fishing industry. The airports still get shut down here because of the wind or the fog. So there was this wonderful and almost terrifying sense that I discovered at 20 years old when I came here from the big city, that, oh my God, I am not only not the center of the universe, I have absolutely no control over it. And therefore, I should pay attention.
Yes.
I think that's what my art practice is. It's a practice of paying attention.
Yes. Well, let's go to the nub of it then, which is this wonderful project, the Encyclopedia of Local Knowledge. How did you come across that idea?
Oh, it's such a long story. It's at this point, it's a 10-year project. So it is a long story, which began as the central creative research creation project of my PhD. I'm a curious woman and not without rigor and discipline. So when I was 57, I had a couple of really big questions about art and about knowledge. And the art community was not really that interested in these questions. So to make art about these questions didn't really make that much sense. And because I'm so used to working in community, I went, well, if I have questions about art as knowledge, then maybe I should be working in a knowledge community. So I went back to school and got a PhD, which was a 4-year commitment to examine deeply a couple of really profound questions for me, which was, can art be knowledge? Can art not only make knowledge and move it around, but can it produce kind of new knowledge? We've lived in this science-biased world in terms of how we define knowledge for centuries. I grew up in it. I was trained in it. And the kind of binaries that art science, dialect that we all grew up with has created is, I think, really wildly simplistic and absolutely inadequate at this historical moment to face what we're facing as a community of cultures trying to build a sustainable futures in a more than human world. And for more humans than just us white folks. So a university community that was just beginning an interdisciplinary PhD seemed like a very interesting idea for me. And it gave me a chance to explore physically, visually, in the field, all the questions I had over that 4-year period, and to undertake the research that supports the first two chapters, or the first chapter of the Encyclopedia of Local Knowledge, because it was a PhD research project, which meant I had funding. I mean, by this time I was a senior artist. I was given excellent funding to pursue this project. I would never have gotten arts grants to spend 8 or 9 months in the field in rural Newfoundland, which is wildly expensive to undertake that kind of field-based research. The first chapter from Bond Bay and the Great Northern Peninsula was my central PhD project. I also wrote an amazing dissertation to put it into conversation with philosophy and epistemology and ecology and geography and all kinds of other things. But the first body of work, the first 92 pages of image and text, right, on everything from how to process squid and sea cucumber to how to read the deck, the wheelhouse of a longliner, to what's the difference between a punt and a skiff. All of that, those 92 pages took place and were made, researched, and completed in that 4-year period. And were toured back to their communities of origin for review and revision. So everybody who participated got a chance to sign off and say, no, you didn't get that right. The moose here eat seagrass, they don't eat sticks. So all of those kinds of editorial decisions were made by the people I call my co-authors, my collaborator, which many other university researchers would call their subjects. These people were not my subjects. These people were my partners, literally my co-authors. It's their knowledge that I am showing you. And yes, I rewrote their interviews. And yes, I took their sentences out of order and occasionally made them sound a little more poetic than they might have sounded in the kitchen when I put them on the first, digital recorder. And yes, I took all those photographs and edited them and did the beautiful page layout and took them back. It was a gigantic project and so privileging. It's very rare to have an excuse, a reasonable and a good excuse, to knock on the door of a stranger and ask for a cup of tea and a conversation. And the entire 10 years of this project, all three chapters, have been like that. So although I'm exhausted from it, truthfully, I also still carry the wild privilege of it. So the first chapter was created in that context. And the second chapter in Fogo Island and on Change Islands was created as the focus of a 1-year postdoctoral fellowship. So again, good funding, right? And the third and so far now final chapter, which is bilingual and took place in one single community, an indigenous community called Miabukek or Con River, and is a Mi'kmaq community, which are some of the native indigenous people of Newfoundland. I raised money from the Federal Arts Council and the Federal Research Council to fund that project, which was more than twice as expensive because it was in full translation. I think it's the first bilingual book in English and Mi'kmaq in Newfoundland. So huge administrative stuff, duties, responsibilities, you know, went into a project like this. And the hot spots, if you want, or the place I got my artistic juice was around those kitchen tables in conversation with those knowledge holders, was being stepping into beginner's mind and asking a stranger to be my teacher. It was a remarkable life experience, and I'm very proud of the work that came out of it. The other big question I was exploring, of course, as a visual artist in a world overwhelmed by text, was how powerful is the visual in terms of, you know, revealing and moving knowledge. You know, so it's an image and text project that really favors the visual in many ways, and which is, I like to think, as much poetics as it is, you know, academic research. Like, this is an art and knowledge project. Art first, knowledge second. And but most people think it's a real encyclopedia. And with, that's a good question.
Going on the title.
Yeah.
Tell me, Pam, you must have faced some resistance. People who thought, you know, who's this nosy Parker coming over, coming around? You know, these are our trade secrets. Somebody's going right. to use them and start some competition. Who's this, you know, white person who wants to steal our knowledge? All right. of these sorts of things. Tell me, well, what kind of doubts did you find and how did you deal with them?
I'm going to answer it chronologically, because in a project like this, your methodology grows, your strategies are you know, enhanced. You learn something by everybody who says no or fuck you. You go, okay, well, why is that? And how could I make that better? And what is the mistake I have made here? I walked into this project deeply advantaged, because I had been, as an artist, working around the inshore fishery in Newfoundland for more than 20 years, which meant I can talk to a skipper. And, you know, because my skipper, who taught me how to use the gurney, how to set a cod trap, what the difference is between, you know, this kind of purse seine and that kind of seine, an otter trawl, those kinds of conversation and vocabularies were already part of my kit, if you want. Because a lot of my work as an artist previous to the encyclopedia was in its own way. I mean, I discovered this idea of local knowledge from my fishing crew, because they were saying words I had never heard before, and they were seeing things in the black water that I couldn't even imagine were down there. And it, like, they could see the bottom, I swear to God, and they could describe it. And so this impulse, and I had just finished a series before I went to PhD school called Things I Learned from Eli Tucker, who was my skipper for 5 years before the North Atlantic Cod Moratorium. And in some ways, he was my first teacher, and showed me quite clearly that there are other ways of knowing the world that don't involve footnotes and academic degrees. And, you know, I mean, it was made crystal clear to me one day on the wharf. We'd come in from hauling traps on a sunny day, and there was a graduate student down on the wharf interviewing Eli about some new DFO regulation or some new piece of gear he was trying out. And you could see the student with their tape recorder and writing things down, and sociology grad student. And, you know, he's talking to Eli and all this stuff and blah, 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 blah. And he said, thank you very much. And he went away. And about a year and a half later, I ran across in a scholarly journal, an article, right, where the student got the credit for that knowledge, not Eli. And that ticks me off. And it really drives me crazy. I'm a woman, I'm a feminist. I've watched other people get credit for knowledge that is not theirs. I don't believe we own knowledge. I don't believe we make it by ourselves. I think we all make it together. It happens between us and the book we're reading or the teacher we're listening to, you know? And so I was ready in that first PhD phase of research to talk to people in communities. And because Eli had taught me a language. So, you know, I had trouble tracking down the crab skippers, but when I finally tracked them down, you know, the first three questions I had for them were interesting enough to them that they said, okay. But the story I tell that explains why the project was easier, got easier and easier, is because when I was going around on the Northern Peninsula, knocking on doors saying, well, hi, I'm like, you know, I'm from the university, I'm an artist, I'm going to like make this thing, it's going to be an encyclopedia, like of local knowledge, kind of, right? And they go, well, what's it going to look like? And I went, I have no idea, because I haven't made it yet. I have not made it yet. I have no idea what I'm going to do with everything you tell me about knitting. No idea. And but when I went to Fogo Island 2 years later, I went with the first chapter in its box. These were originally loose pages, exhibition size, 11 by 20 or whatever they are, 11 by 17. And that box went under my arm into every kitchen I walked into on Fogo Island. So that when they said, Pam, what is this going to look like? I opened up the box. Right? And often they would not speak to me again until they had gone through all 92 pages. And I said, it's going to look like that, except it's going to be about here, you know? And they went, we're in. Now, the place where it got interesting and more challenging was when, as a white person, I went into an Indigenous community to talk to them about their knowledge. And because, you know, I had been a PhD student, I knew all about the ethics. And I'm a documentary filmmaker. I know all about release forms. I haven't taken a person's picture without their permission for 25 years. So it wasn't strange territory for me, but I was really determined to do it properly because I knew it was going to be extremely suspiciously regarded, and that if we were going to do this, we had to do it the right way. So I did it with an Indigenous partner. I have a friend, Jerry Evans, who's a Mi'kmaq artist who I've known since he was in his 20s. And I called him up and I said, I'm thinking about doing this, Jerry, but I don't think I should do it without an Indigenous partner. He goes, yeah, you're right about that. I said, well, what do you think? Would you be that partner? And he said, yeah, totally. Let me call the chief. See what the chief thinks. When I asked Jerry, my friend, to join me in this project, I had no idea he had relationships in Con River. I mean, I knew he had relationships in the Mi'kmaq community, but I didn't realize they were in Con River. So we actually went down for a kind of a 2 week, 1 month residency to talk to the band council and present the idea and just see if there was a comfortable partnership there. At that point, we worked out all our protocols and procedures in writing. We had them all approved by the band council before we ever went back down. We started writing our first grants, which we sent to an Indigenous jury federally. So we were going, okay, well, they'll, you know, make sure we're doing this properly too. So it was not entirely a new process when we went into Con River, but it was even more rigorous than anywhere else. Like, it had been getting more and more rigorous. And I just think it's very important that people understand that the permissions we got were non-commercial, all right? So that we can go and exhibit this work as artists, you know, blah, blah, blah. But in all the release signs everybody signed, there's a sentence saying, if commercial use is made of this work, the royalties will be shared with the community. And 2.5 weeks ago, I think, you could check my Facebook page for the exact date, Jerry, who was down in Con River where he's building a house, presented a check for $5,000 to the band in Con River, which represents more than their share of the royalties from the whole book. Because the encyclopedia exists in multiple forms. It exists online, it exists in these boxes, these limited edition boxes of artwork, and in published hardcover book form. So it's those hardcover books that are making money, and it's not very much money, but it's not our intellectual property. So in the case of Con River, we split the royalties from that production three ways. A third for me, a third for Jerry, and a third for the community.
Well, I'm assuming that the monetary reward isn't the main value that people saw in this project. So
no.
what was the value? Sometimes these projects can be a little elegiac. It's about some particular practice, local practice, that may be dying because of climate change or change in competition or a lack of interest by the next generation and taking up those skills. Was there a sense that these were knowledges endangered, or was it more a kind of a point of just pride that this was something hard won and passed down through generations and somebody was recognizing them as valuable?
I think in all three chapters, but especially in chapter three, Miyabukak, the Middle River, the Indigenous chapter, there was real concern about elders passing on. A lot of the local Mi'kmaq knowledge had been already stripped away. Their language had been lost. You know, so there's a very much more commitment to trying to reclaim, you know, and archive some of this stuff in chapter three. And for Jerry, that these are his people, there was a real concern to try and hold, reclaim, recover, reuse, honor, and celebrate this knowledge that was being lost and is just beginning to be reclaimed now, right? And like, they stopped making baskets in Con River, you know, four generations ago. So they're having to relearn that, you know? So yes, and Newfoundland is a small province. It's a province with a long history, big colonial history, big Irish history here. They don't feel like they're not Indigenous, the Irish especially, who've been seven generations in Tilting alone on Fogo Island. So deep commitment to heritage and traditional knowledge, etc. The interesting thing, so many people like this series, admire this series, as folklore, as traditional knowledge, and as precisely as that kind of preservation impulse to hold it before it's lost. For me, this is not my primary impulse. I'm very happy that I have documented how to build a punt with a half model or a rod and a rising board method, right? There are still people building wooden punts. We have two of the most remarkable wooden boat museums in the world here. And I'm happy that these things are being held. My concern is more political, literally small p political, big E epistemology. Because for me, all of the knowledge that is in all of the three chapters of the encyclopedia is live, lively, and still being fruitfully put to use. Even if it's being put to use for a tourist, it is still, and it's nimble. It is not a dead and dying thing. I think we make a huge mistake to see knowledge as static. I am a person who believes knowledge is a verb, not a noun. And so the idea that it is thing-like and does not respond, I think we can learn a huge amount to watch and document how old knowledge is nimble in the face of environmental change. I mean, there's generations of guys who were fishing the inshore North Atlantic cod who had to learn to fish crab less than 25 years ago. That was not an easy shift, but they did it easily because they are local knowers, which to me means they are engaged knowers in specific place. I mean, there's knowledge on one side of the bay where there's eelgrass growing that is not shared on the other side of the bay, which has got a rocky bottom. You know, because the fishers over on the other side of the bay don't need to know what the guys who are catching spawning salmon at a different time of year need to know. So for me, this is about how we know in place as humans, in very specific, particular place. No one lives somewhere in general. We all live somewhere particular, you know? And, you know, even the lady who runs the Chinese restaurant on Fogo Island grows her garden in the same bioregion as the guy who grew up in Ireland or whose grandfather grew up in Ireland. But she grows hers a little differently because she's mixing up her local knowledge because she has multiple heritage to pull from. So for me, that's the core. What
that brings
me
us
about
to
the
conundrum, which is here I am in Australia, and my listeners are from all around the world listening to you talking about a knowledge that seems so specific to your island, but no doubt we're interested and particularly inspired by it. But to what extent do you think it's possible to grow that kind of knowledge to other places? Do you find projects that are aligned with yours in other parts of the world? Are you thinking, in fact, of scaling it up to other parts of, say, Canada?
I would love to scale it up, actually, and am considering a couple of ways. And again, I just want to draw a line under the knowledge as a verb thing as versus knowledge as a noun. Yes, the specific knowledge of marine species that you need to have a livelihood in Trinity Bay in the North Atlantic is quite different than the fishing knowledge that you would get in various areas around coastal Australia. But what is not different, I would posit, right, is the ways of knowing, right, are the human engagements from which knowledge springs. And to me, what the encyclopedia is showing are kind of the most connected. These are people living in a rural environment. They're not living in glass buildings all the time. So I actually think that there's a huge amount in common in terms of the way people are moving through their place. Before I came to Newfoundland, I spent some time in northern Scotland, in the Western Isles, in the Orkneys. And this, there is no doubt in my mind that those communities up and down those islands, up and down those coasts, have precisely the same kinds of local knowledge about their place, right? Which are equally as influenced by physical lived experience in a particular bioregion, as well as by the history and the stories of their ancestors, because that's the other piece of it. And so, yeah, I would defy anybody to kind of prove or to convince me that there is not a huge amount in common, more in common than less, I think. You know, I mean, we use the world in many of the same ways. You know, we use the world for shelter. We use the world for sustenance. We use the world to, you know, embrace our spirit. We use the plants of the world to feed us and heal us. You know, we use other materials in the world to help us move from place to place. I mean, all of us have these things in common, you know?
Yes, in Australia, anyway. Certainly, you know, we have a tradition of what's called make do, which we found in other cultures, which perhaps speaks to the kind of heuristic idea of knowledge rather than a static one that you're talking about. So, but thinking about scaling things, is the project going to develop further? I imagine there are other parts of the island still that could be explored, but are you thinking of going beyond Newfoundland?
I'm actually, at this point, I'm taking a break because this, as I said when I started, this has been a decade, more than a decade of engagement in what is incredibly demanding collaborative work. And I've done lots of collaborative work as an artist, but normally I work on a collaborative project and then I work in my studio to, you know, I work for myself, for my own voice to get strong enough to go and work with people again. The encyclopedia over this last decade has been, you know, wildly demanding in that way, especially since I've had to raise the money for it and administer the money for it and do all that stuff. And because it's field-based and place-based, it's expensive to get yourself into those situations. But so, yeah, I'm back in my own studio working on a project now. And as I'm thinking about the future of the encyclopedia, I am thinking about going farther afield. Not because I'm not interested in exploring Newfoundland or certainly Labrador, which is part of our province and is across the Straits of Belle Isle, attached to Quebec. And, you know, so we have that whole north part of our province. But I'm actually think I want to start drawing out those commonalities. I like the idea of working on other islands. So I've been in conversation with some scholars in Norway who, you know, would like to maybe get me over there to work with the Sami and some of the coastal Norwegian fishers and birders and all those coastal islands. I would love to go back to northern Scotland. I would love to go to Tasmania. I hear they have a remarkable making museum there, which is on my bucket list. And I don't know if I believe that island people know their world differently, but I've been living by the ocean for more than 50 years now, and I am kind of convinced that it keeps humans a little more humble than, you know, a larger, less wild environment. You know, when we forget about the weather, we're in trouble.
Indeed. And can I ask you about the longevity of it? And this is certainly an issue for Garland, which has nearly 1,700 stories now. Think often about what happens to those stories when the internet goes down or gets lost, no longer visible in Google and so on. Obviously, you're publishing these as books, so books to an extent even though they're not as accessible as something online, they do have that longevity. Would you consider, for instance, starting an institution or something that can archive this kind of knowledge?
I've been thinking about that because I'm getting old, you know, and I live in a big Victorian house which is full of stuff, and I make stuff. So I'm actually thinking very carefully about where to place the encyclopedia. Now, right from the beginning, it existed in boxes.
Now, listener, Pam is going to the other side of her room to bring out to the microphone so you can see it, an archive box.
This is the first form, right? This is a box, and it's full of separate panels, right? And
beautifully reproduced panels that could easily go on the wall as an exhibition.
Absolutely, and have been. This was their first form. This gets exhibited, and there are 10 copies of each chapter that live in this form. Two of them are owned by Memorial University, one in their St. John's Library, one in their Cornerbrook Library. Two of them belong to the artist. The rest of them belong to the communities. So on Fogo Island, you can go into their visitor center and they have pages framed. You can go into their little community museums and they have various pages framed, et cetera. And the big Miao Bukek, the Middle River, is in a huge art exhibition in Grossmoor National Park right now, where a lot of the pages have been blown up, you know, into large artworks, and there's a real skin boat in there and caribou carving from the community. It's a beautiful exhibition, which will be returned to Con River so they can put it in their cultural center. So there's the materiality of the artwork and the boxes. There's the materiality of the books, right? Now, if you go on to the encyclopedia website, you know, there's a tab on the other, like on the far right-hand side, and it says about the elk, which is what we call the encyclopedia, the elk. And if you scroll down through there, you can see images of the boxes, images of the books, images of some of the exhibitions, etc. So we're doing our best. Oh, and the best place it occurs, Kevin, which makes me so happy, is the University Library in St. John's, the Queen Elizabeth Library, has taken the files and blown them up and covered the entire wall of their reference library. And I love that my encyclopedia is in there with their encyclopedias. But the challenge is, I mean, I'm keeping that website online. I'm paying for the security services, I'm paying for the doodahs and the surveying. And so I'm in the process of beginning a conversation with the university to see if they will accept it as a gift. You know, they own the work, they've owned the work since the beginning. And I think the university is a good place for it to be because, you know, they already have supported the project so much, and they have free access to those PDF files, you know.
Well, that would be wonderful. It certainly is the ideal of a university as a keeper of knowledge.
Yeah.
Not just somebody who gets big grants and distributes funds, but also has this sort of community role in terms of preserving knowledge. That would be terrific.
Well, when you think about their libraries, the library of the University of Melbourne and of, you know, Oxford and, you know, NYU and all of the great universities of the world are repositories for all the knowledge of all the dead white guys who have ever friggin' made knowledge. And it's been used to teach the rest of us, you know, for centuries, which means to have this knowledge in that context, for me was the kind of the foundational radical intervention, if you want, into the university library to get these knitters and fishers and bakers and pickle makers and, you know, folks who live in the world in an extremely knowledgeable way in with all the other knowledge holders that the university has been, you know, caring for all these years. So I'm hoping they'll say yes. I mean, they already have the hard copies and they already use those pages to decorate their hallways. So I'm hoping that they'll take the website over, which would be great.
Yes,
because, you know, at some point I'm going to die and nobody will pay the server fees, you know?
Well, we'll hopefully be disseminating this project a little further, Pam, in space
that
and
would
time.
Be great.
But I want to thank you so much for sharing your time with us. It's been a really interesting conversation. It certainly connects quite closely to the role of thinker-maker that has been an important one within Garland, of both reflecting those who've been through universities, craftspeople who combine practical skills with theoretical knowledge. But also you've opened up something new to me, which is the idea that knowledge can be a creative medium in itself. I've seen glimmers of that around, and certainly when you look at the way craft is presented in social media, particularly, you know, YouTube and Instagram Reels and so on, what you're finding is as much videos demonstrating techniques, sometimes very beautifully produced and generously offered, as the actual final product. And I think this maybe is something that we're a bit blind to, thinking that teaching is just a means to an end. But in your case, I think it can be something quite creative as well.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the interest, and I appreciate being able to throw this project a little bit further out into the world. You know, it takes art and knowledge a long time to move. And even though we do have an internet, I think it's almost overwhelming. There's so much out there. It gives me, I mean, I've had people write me who stumbled on the website going, oh my God, this is amazing. This is helping me do my grad work. Or, you know, where can I get this book? I read on the website, there's a book, I need to give it to my grandmother. And so it's been, I think, a really, I know it's been inspiring to other folks, other researchers. I know it's been inspiring to knowledge holders, to the grandmothers who spoke to me and who could show their grandchild their page on mittens in this book, which was profound. And, you know, I've been making art for a long time, and it's certainly been my choice to walk that path. But this is the only project that I've ever made in my entire creative career where anyone thanked me for making it.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. And so thank you very much, Pam. And apologies in advance if you'll get a lot more emails.
That's okay.
Different parts of the world.
That's okay. I'm still interested in these conversations very much, and I am far from finished.
Good.
You've been listening to a podcast from Garland Magazine. Please check our website, garlandmag.com, for more stories behind what we make.